Rated T to M.
Levels. Check my levels.
This show is about conversation.
Conversations with interesting,
creative people.
Creative.
Talented people.
Talented people.
This is a Rational Interview.
This is Ken Levine.
I'm Sean Elliott.
And I'm Chris Remo.
And we call this show Irrational Interviews.
I have a sense of completely misplaced pride about our guest today. And I say this is misplaced because I've had absolutely nothing at all to do with his success. But I've gotten real joy out of watching Kieran Gillen go from being a journalist who I respected and liked to being a proprietor of a website, Rock Paper Shotgun, that I respect and like, to fulfilling vicariously a fantasy I had as a kid, which is writing Marvel Comics. So I ran into him again recently at the Bioshock Infinite launch thing, and I'm like, you know, this guy, he's like the triple threat. Journalist, blogger, comic book writer. We got to get him on the show. And since we recorded this interview, we learned that Kieran's left journalism to go on to a full-time job at Marvel, writing for them exclusively. So without further ado, let's listen to our interview with Kieran Gillen.
How's it going?
Good, actually. You've just called me at the end of Friday, so I've actually finished work. So I'm sitting here with a glass of wine and actually quite happy with the world.
Yeah.
That's not fair, because we're still in the middle of the workday.
Yeah, hard afternoon to go.
Yeah.
What does that mean for you to be done with work?
It means I've done what I wanted to get done by any point, because there's always more work I could be doing.
Right.
But it's all like kind of, like, basically my plan was to finish a script by the end of the day. And I've finished the script by the end of the day, so I can basically, you know, relax a little. I don't know if it's any good, but it's definitely in a state that could be described as finished.
In Kieran's case, you started out doing game journalism. Ken, you started out in theater and film. Mm-hmm. Do you guys feel like you've found the form that you really can speak through?
I certainly feel lucky in that kind of way. And people actually ask me, have you got any like ambitions to write a novel or, you know, write a screenplay or anything like that? And I really don't. I'm very much in the position where I do think I've found something which I'm interested in writing for. As in, what interests me about writing for comics is at least partially the fact it is comics. It's not really like anything else. And in terms of the payoff between control and speed, it's very interesting. And I also like the fact it's this very strange underdog medium, which is kind of like part of the appeal for me in that kind of way.
Do you have that desire to write that novel? Do you have the desire to write that screenplay? Or are comics a stepping stone? Because I think now, the way comics are, I think comics to some degree, for better or for worse, from the money side, views itself as a stepping stone rather than an end.
A good way of putting it is never say never, but people do ask me that, and they kind of do a presumption that you would like to move out of the comics, and no, it's like a lot of the things that makes comics quite unattractive to people are things that make it attractive to me, and the idea that it's such a relatively low-budget field. You have the ability to innovate in terms of and actually iterate in terms of your ideas very, very quickly. And it's also a medium where you can sort of play around with it a bit in terms of actual formalist excellence, quote-unquote. There's stuff that people haven't done in comics properly yet, that there's still room to sort of push it a bit. And if you're writing a novel, you're never going to write Ulysses. Most of the very cool stuff that to be done has been done. And as a mature art form, they're out something else. Comics, they had this extended adolescence, means that there's still quite interesting stuff to do. And I've always been kind of like basically a neophile. And the fact that there is kind of ways you can push comics which are relatively fresh soil makes them attractive to me, and that's why I'm very much there. The way I'm lining myself at the moment for the next 3, 4, 5 years, all I can see is comics, really. And that's definitely where my heart is. And yes, the money's not as good as, say, a film would be. I was a games journalist for 15 years. If money was any form of motivation, you know, I would not be there, you know?
Yeah, but dude, you run that blog, and money must be pouring in from that. Like, how do you even spend it all?
Eventually, we've started to hire people to spend it all. It's a bit like, you know, it's like Brewster's Millions. We've kind of got a series of servants who go out and just spritter it away.
So you've got comics, you got a game blog, and game journalism. I mean, you just must be like the queen.
My 13-year-old self is very impressed. You know,
we work in video games, and you work in comics, and like my life is exactly what I wanted to be when I was 11. Now, all I wanted when I was 11 was an Apple II and Bo Derek.
And I got a beautiful wife and an Xbox 360 now. So I feel like I've achieved all my goals. I guess I could die now. Do you feel the same way?
A little bit. I mean, my fiance says this about me, that I'm not allowed to talk to her friend's children because I give them the wrong idea about what you can do when you grow up. And I'm like, no, don't speak to Uncle Kieran. He'll make you just go and write about video games.
Yeah, I think even my relatives don't quite understand. They'll come to the house and they'll see my house that's full of Bruce Timm drawings and Big Daddy and Little Sister in the living room. And they kind of think I'm going to grow out of it or something. And I don't think they realize this is it. My 11-year-old face sort of solidified and hardened, and it's not really going to change anytime soon. It's not like, you know, when people meet a doctor or a lawyer and they sort of say that's a valid lifestyle. I think it's like in some ways that there are people who are comfortable with homosexuality, but they don't want to see two guys kissing at the same time. I think there are people comfortable with being nerds, but they don't want to come to my house and see my Scarlet Witch statue.
I'm curious about that because, Kieran, you talked about the kind of extended cultural adolescence of comics. And I wonder if games maybe aren't still in that phase. And Ken, when Kieran was talking about still being able to explore new ground in comics, did that resonate at all with you in terms of games?
It's interesting because comics as an art form have been around for a very long time. But even as I've observed it, it went through substantial changes. You know, you get Frank Miller coming in, you get The Watchmen coming in. And comics are unrecognizable mostly from when I was a kid. Games, I think, were still even in an earlier phase. Yeah. I was thinking about this conversation Kieran and I were going to have a couple of days ago, and I was talking to a friend of mine about it. So I was thinking about you working on Thor, and you're coming into a franchise that's 48 years old. And I know from coming into Bioshock and, like, well, not coming into Bioshock, but creating Bioshock with the team and then coming in and sort of trying to reinvent it and how interesting that is. Well, what's it like, Kieran, coming into Thor after 48 years and, A, trying to find something different to do with it, and, B, trying to be respectful of what it is as a property and as a franchise and something that people love so much?
Occasionally I don't do the maths on something like Superman and Batman and try to work out how many quote-unquote Batman or Superman stories have been told and compare that to other historical characters. And just through the basic force of advanced capitalism, there must be more Batman or Superman stories, or maybe X-Men, depending how quickly they did it, than any other form of story in existence.
Yeah.
And that's just like you know, it's a stupidly scary number. And you think, you know, what is actually new and interesting there? And what makes it vaguely feasible to do is the idea that whilst the stories back there remain the same, the world keeps on changing. And thus, the context of what is actually meaningful or not alters. And, you know, and the characters must reflect the day. Part of it's just really, really scary. You know, you pick up a comic. In fact, I've got a comic on the shelf near me, and it's far older than I am. If this character was here before I was born, he's probably going to be there when I'm dead. Thor, as the larger meta myth of the actual Norse god, people will still be talking about Thor forever in that real way, as long as there's humans to sort of tell these stupid stories to one another. What you do is you kind of boil it down to the essentials in that kind of way. You look at what does actually that character really mean. I mean, I always use the example of Beta Ray Bill, because before doing Thor, I did Beta Ray Bill. And Beta Ray Bill, for people who don't know, the idea is alien creature who is protecting his race, and due to situations too complicated to explain, gained up getting the power of Thor. So in other words, he's a big horse-faced alien with a hammer and the hat and everything. And of course, when I started writing about that, what does that really mean? Well, you know, okay, he's an alien, that means he's science fiction. You know, science fiction is fundamentally a rationalistic, atheistic worldview. It believes that everything is explicable. However, he's also a god, in which case, you know, this is about theology, this is about fantasy, this is about the idea of the irrational and stuff, which is about a leap of faith. So in other words, he actually embodies these two polar ways of actually processing the universe. So I started thinking about the idea of, you know, divinity and humanity and actually the question of essentially tracing God, and end up with a story where he tries to hunt down and kill Galactus. So it kind of, I turned him into this ultimate atheistic statement and tries to hunt down what's conceived by Kirby as God.
As a god.
Yeah. And that's the kind of idea. You kind of boil down to the essentials and kind of just rip what is the core. And then you kind of build on top of that what's actually relevant now. And you listen to the gut. We talk about the zeitgeist elements, the idea of what actually resonates today. As a brief break, can you actually hear piano in the background?
Yeah, yes.
Allow me to stop my girlfriend playing the piano.
Okay, thanks. Well, actually, that was great. I think we're going to keep that moment in the podcast.
Yeah, that's character.
Should be very proud of that.
I know Chris has a question, but I want to ask one question, one follow-up question first on Thor. So Thor is an interesting character because I think as a writer, I look at Thor as probably the character I'd have the hardest time writing in Marvel Comics because Marvel Comics is so technocratic. You know, you have Tony Stark and then you have Thor, and Thor is such the opposite. And he's carrying around this giant mythology around with him as well. He's got Asgard, Baldur and Sif and Odin and all these other characters. The second part is you've got this giant juggernaut of a movie coming out. It seems like you have a lot of baggage to deal with as a writer.
When I actually took over the book, there was the third aspect in that I was taking over after JMS left, and JMS had an incredibly critically acclaimed run.
For people who don't know, that's Straczynski, who created Babylon 5 and a bunch of other things and wrote a ton of great Marvel comics and had a long run on Thor.
Yes, and they were very big shoes, and I had very tiny feet. As well as the history, as well as the current situation, I basically went into Thor thinking I was doomed. And I had a kind of like fatalistic kamikaze view of it, in the idea that everyone's going to hate me, so it doesn't matter. Therefore, all that really matters is trying to do the best I can. So it's not even worth worrying about. And in the end, actually, people genuinely really liked the run, so it turned out okay. So that was the situation I found myself. The stuff like the movie didn't even enter my thoughts. There were things which were nearer and scarier than the movie to bother me, especially because the fact that the movie was already in production and, had already had its course set.
To go back to something you were saying earlier, you spoke about one of the ways that you keep this character new and interesting and relevant is acknowledging that the world is changing and things that happen now versus things that happened a decade, 2 decades, 3 decades ago have different resonance. That's something that it seems to me an extremely strong parallel to BioShock, in that while BioShock isn't necessarily about history, it's certainly set in historical periods. And I'm curious how much you think about communicating particular themes, or how much you just trust that reactions and relevance will just arise out of creating that context for people.
I normally know my themes before I start. The last arc I did it for was basically He goes to hell to basically sort some stuff out, and it's basically a story involving Mephisto, basically the surrogate devil figure in the Marvel Universe, and Hela, who is the ruler of hell in Norse mythology, and they're basically cohabiting, yet again for reasons too complex to explain. The whole story is basically a mash between Christian and Norse mythology. I kind of wanted to take basically a postmodern conceit about the idea of coexisting theologies and just mash them together and treat that as just the way it is. The other sort of subtext that came through is that I was basically getting engaged at the same time. I just got engaged, and I've never been engaged before, and I've never been the sort of long-term dating sort of guy. And I was also involved in several contractual organisations at the same time. The idea that, I was talking to lawyers about a variety of stuff. And this whole arc is about people being trapped in contracts, being destroyed at ever. And the final image is a ring made out of, a frozen, entirely tormented zombie Valkyrie ladies around the devil's finger. This is all very clear. All my fears about actually being in a legal situation or being in being engaged, basically, are totally visible in this book. And there's no way I could possibly stop that.
I realized after, actually, we presented the game in New York, in BioShock Infinite New York, how the story we were telling was tied into my own personal life. Both BioShock Infinite and BioShock are games about creations of humanity, right? Cities in this case, that people create these things, and then the creation becomes larger than they are and becomes something that they become beholden to in a lot of ways. I sort of realize this after the fact sometimes, that the thing I'm working on is a reflection of what I'm going through in my own life to some degree. Is that happened by accident? And then you realize afterwards, holy shit, I'm really talking about the lawyers here, or I'm really talking about my marriage here, or I'm really talking about something else in my life.
You have a moment of realization, you go, oh, fuck. In that kind of yes, you are just basically a mud pit, and stuff just bubble up. The stories you write is what's on your mind, or your worries and your fears. A lot about being a writer is actually just genuinely picking at your worries, or your hopes, or especially the stuff you don't like about yourself. One of my sort of themes I tend to come back to is the idea of how humans are shaped by their art. This is the theme of my indie book, Phonogram. It drops into Thor quite a bit. Why am I so obsessed with the idea that something is quite shallow? Because art, whilst it's transcendent, isn't as important as food. But to me, it really is. So, what is that that's wrong in my head that forces me to go that way?
I think one of the great things about you working on Thor, or us working on these video games, I like working on sort of these fantastical genre things, because you can be a lot more self-indulgent without people noticing. If you were to write a book about some guy getting engaged, because it's sort of realistic, like you're writing about some guy in the UK, you know, getting engaged to some girl who's a games journalist, it has that problem of becoming super, super self-indulgent and super close to home. And you don't have that range of metaphor to work in. Having a city in the sky to work with as a notion of an idea that pops out of somebody's head and that idea may be controlling them is something that is, to me, easier to do than writing something much more realistic and much more naturalistic about problems I may go through in my everyday life. I don't know if I could write that story about some nerdy Jewish kid running a video game company. I think that would become dull.
I agree. I mean, it's a necessary distance. Are you aware of the Eddie Campbell's Alec books? He's probably best known. He was the artist from Hell, but he kind of was one of the big autobiographical comic guys in Britain. And his Alec books are brilliant. However, he's not called Alec. You know, he's Eddie Campbell. And the fact he renames all the characters and he plays very very Pinterest-esque sort of narrative structures. The fact he needs a necessary distance even when doing autobiography. I mean, he's a very big influence on me, especially with my fantasy stuff. The idea that, you know, that the fantasy allows you to actually tackle this stuff in a more direct, head-on way. You talk about the idea of stuff bubbling up and you generally only recognise it after you've done it. Is the thing, and you go, oh yeah, that's totally where my head was. As in, yeah. I look back and think, see, when I've split up with the girlfriend previously, it's like, yeah, I can see where that story came from. It's on the nose if you kind of just do it that way. But it's like my first four arc involved two kings and Baldur, who was ruling Asgard at the time, and Doctor Doom, who is Doctor Doom. And kind of about halfway through the story, I kind of realised they are both basically me. In the idea that they're both, it's about the idea.
I've always thought that about you, Kieran.
That's true.
Craig, you as Dr. Doom.
Oh, totally. It's the idea that Dr. Doom thinks that no one must never look down on me, I will. And his whole motivation was to drag gods down to his level for this story. Because also Baldur is painfully aware of the fact that he's doing a job he's not qualified for. The idea that, you know, who am I to be in charge of us? I'm not Odin. What on earth am I doing? And you don't need to go very far to basically look at me, who's like a relatively new comic writer, taking over a very large book, following a very large writer. The idea that recognising the unattractive bits of you allows you to sort of process those characters, I think. I don't know.
You know, I think that's a good point. I mean, Doom, for all his like robots and stuff like that, what makes him interesting is his origin is rooted in his insecurity. He had to prove himself to Reed Richards, who became Mr. Fantastic, that he was better than him. And I think he was building a time machine, right? And Richards was telling him, you made some mistakes in your calculations. And Doom said, like, you know, go fuck yourself. And then the machine explodes and scars him forever. I mean, that's why he wears that mask. And there's such a great... It's such a great pain in that origin. As goofy as Dr. Doom is, the guy in the suit of armor and the green cape, there's such a great core there. And I think that was the brilliance of Lee and Kirby and Ditko, is recognizing that there's pain at the root of a lot of these larger-than-life figures. Pain and insecurity and doubt. And that's what drives them and makes them interesting.
You've got to at least somehow empathize with the villain, otherwise it's quote-unquote comic book. You know, the idea that you've got to somehow, I kind of get Magneto, you know what I mean? And it's like Ryan, he's a really good example of, occasionally you go, yeah, I can see his point. The scene when he's being clubbed to death, you go, yeah, there's a guy who had the courage of his convictions, at least at that moment.
I think we've all been in the place where we've argued ourselves into a corner, and even though we kind of know that we're wrong, we just can't back out of it because we have too much sunk cost, too much emotional investment in. For me, the most interesting log to write for Ryan was the one where he kind of realizes he's fucked it up, and he kind of realizes it's broken, but he can't reverse himself. And who hasn't been in an argument with their wife or their girlfriend, and you realize she's completely right, but the arguments are going on for 2 hours already, and how do you get yourself off that perch that you put yourself on? And I think that's such an interesting place to write a supervillain into.
Imagine how different the internet would be if people could suddenly realize they were wrong and say sorry.
Good transition. Go ahead.
On that note, Kieran, you're one of the people responsible for Rock, Paper, Shotgun. There's a passionate community there. Both games and comics seem to have the distinct ability to attract extremely vocal, passionate people. Both of you guys have to deal with this. In fact, people on Rock, Paper, Shotgun comment on the games Ken makes. So, I mean, there's interplay there even. How do you take that into consideration? Do you try to get the pulse from that crowd?
You have to adopt a layer of skin that you didn't have before, because I think it's incredibly important to expose yourself to what people think about your game and about what you do. before, I was realizing that this thing, BioShock, we created, it becomes larger than yourself. I don't know if BioShock will be around when I'm dead, but it certainly becomes something that people have a connection with, that people have no idea who I am. It's important that you leave yourself open to criticism, but you also, I think, have to understand that if you try to react to every negative comment on the internet, and I don't just mean react from like getting on the board and, you know, defending yourself in any way, because that's kind of pointless. I don't think that's a really productive exercise. But also reacting in your work, you have to be very careful that you're not reading the internet and somebody says something mean about what you do, and then you go off and you say, oh my God, I've got to change everything I do. But on the other hand, I think it's important that these are the people. There are people who have a vested interest in what you do and have an understanding and a passion for what you do and have relevant viewpoints. And you need to listen to those people in a macro sense. And it's more important to listen to, I think, the fact that if they're really unhappy about something, to recognize the unhappiness rather than adhere to the solutions. Because your job as a creator is a solution job, right? Well, there's two parts. There's recognizing problems, and the internet can help you with that sometimes. It can definitely help you with that sometimes. But coming up with solutions, you're never going to get like a particular solution from the internet that you can count on, because there's going to be 1,000 solutions, and maybe one or two people might have solutions that are going to be interesting and useful, or maybe a lot of people have solutions that are useful and interesting. But it's your judgment and the judgment of the people you work with that's going to drive that solution process.
And that's playtesting games, basically. I mean, it goes all the way down to the micro level where, you know, you say you rely on playtesters to figure out where you as the creators need to put your attention.
Oh, yeah. When we tested BioShock, the first time, like, we showed that first level, the level that became the demo of the game. And we showed this a few months before we shipped it, and people hated it. Like, it was so depressing. Like, you think the comments on the internet board get nasty. Like, we were behind the glass window, and people were like, this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen. You know, why are you in this stupid world and being attacked by zombies? And they just hated everything. Like, who's that stupid Australian guy talking to you? You know, that's what they called Atlas. And my partner, my business partner, John Che, who's Australian, was, like, rolling his eyes and getting very depressed. And what was interesting is about, you know, the team went back to work the next day. It was a Sunday, actually. We went back to the office and we said, okay, here's all the things people said about it. And what do we do now? How do we fix this and get this to be something people like? And the key was understanding consensus on what people don't like, interpreting that, sort of reading the tea leaves of that, and then saying, what are they actually saying here? Things like the scene on the airplane at the very beginning of the game where Jack Ryan is sitting there smoking a cigarette, that didn't exist. The game originally started in the water. Just adding that bit on the airplane so people understood who you were all of a sudden grounded everybody in the experience. But nobody said in that session, you know what you need? You need a scene on an airplane. We wouldn't have gotten there unless we exposed ourselves to incredibly, incredibly vocal critics.
So one of the things that Irrational now faces is that, I mean, BioShock was a huge game. It sold millions of copies. Karen, you're writing Thor, which I don't know what comic circulations are like, but that's a big character a lot of people know. Karen, your first major comic work was Phonogram, a much smaller thing. Ken, Irrational Games went years making games that were critically loved, but not really huge success stories. And now both of you guys are working on these things that have built-in huge audiences already, you know, aside from whatever additional audience you accrue through your work. How does it feel to have gone through those transitions?
It's necessary, isn't it? It's like, it must be different for like a company, because for a writer, you're much more mobile. The idea that Phonogram was, of course, critically acclaimed, commercially suicidal. I feel incredibly lucky to have been able to do that book. But it was also the book that I were offered a lot of work off the back of that. It was something that people thought had a quote-unquote vision or whatever. It didn't pay me any money, but every penny I've been paid since has owed something to it. You know what I mean?
It became your calling card.
Yeah, totally. It's the indie film guy who's made the short, and that leads to other things. And even before Phonogram, I was doing like small black and white fanzine level comics, like in the British Small Press, you know, which of course have had a readership of literally 4. But all that was still the same in that, you know, I put out one of these comics, then somebody said, oh, we should do a book together. And that led to a slightly bigger job. The noughties was me essentially gambling. It was like, shall you collect or gamble on the gambling machine? And I just kept on pressing gambling. By the end of the noughties, I was writing 4. You just got to have the faith in the idea that doing good work will eventually find an audience. Good stuff doesn't necessarily sell. But good stuff is at least as much chance of selling as bad stuff. And to sort of give up on the idea that good stuff never does sell is the definition of self-defeating. And the only way you change culture is by engaging it.
Obviously, there's an entrepreneurial part of you. You know, I think to be a comic book writer, you need to be an entrepreneur, you know, because you have to drive that career so much yourself. To build a successful gaming blog, you need to be an entrepreneur rather than just waiting for some editor to give you work. What led you to start up Rock, Paper, Shotgun? And what was the impulse there to take on all the good and bad that comes with any kind of entrepreneurial endeavor?
If you basically go back to the roots of the video gaming internet, the gaming blogs were primarily PC. You're looking at stuff like, say, Evil Avatar or Blues News, that kind of stuff back in the day. As you went into the 2000s, they just started covering console stuff as well, which is, of course, completely natural because gamers are basically into games. I play 360 stuff as well, you know? But as I went through, we became painfully aware of the fact that there's only so many hours in a day and so many eyes to look at stuff. There was so much stuff happening on the PC that wasn't being covered, or at least wasn't being covered to our satisfaction. And the fact there wasn't a major English language PC blog just struck us as slightly obscene. Really, it was a case of the fact that this was a website we wanted to read that didn't exist, and we felt that we should bring it into being by our sheer will. Well, we thought the PC was very exciting. And so the idea that it is just first-person shooters and RTS games. I mean, you know, and we love first-person shooters and RTS games. But we wanted to try to create a site that kind of embraced everything. The idea that it could be like a hex-based game played by two people and their dogs. It could be some random web game. It could be all the experimental flash platformers, all these European games, all the free-to-play MMOs, all the hyper-casual PopCap stuff, eventually the Facebook games. All this is fundamentally PC gaming. We wanted to basically create a blog that kind of admitted that and threw a few knob gags in as well.
So to me, when I think of Rock, Paper, Shotgun, it's a site where I go to be exposed to stuff I didn't know about before. Let me ask you a question. When you created it, how has it led into your expectations? How has it defied your expectations? The site is part what you create and part what your community creates. Is it what you thought it would be? Does it surprise you, this creation of yours?
Occasionally, it pays you back wonderfully. Occasionally, it breaks your heart. There's stuff which has happened in terms of the community and, you know, and they get angry and they get passionate. These are basically smart human beings who are generally, but you say that these are passionate people. They're our audience. They're the guys who read what we do. And it just feels good to be right. When we formed the site, we believed there would be an audience for it, and there is. I think our biggest story the last month was we announced a game called Dead State, which is basically a zombie-based RPG by some ex-Obsidian people. But that's our biggest story, and that's because we're the only people who covered it. We found the game we really liked, we championed it. And stuff like The Void and stuff like Solium Infernum and these sort of games, you assume it's a stupid thing to cover, but we're writing about stuff that no one else is. Therefore, if people want to read about it, they come to us. So it's actually a sensible thing to do in a business sense.
I'm curious, Ken, if that arc that Karen describes about having this thing you need to do and eventually finding you've been proven right, I mean, does that resonate at all with you, with the arc of what you've done at Irrational?
It's very tough to run a game business in your spare time, at least when we were doing. We were the kind of games we were making, the kind of deals we had to make. And we were always sort of on the knife's edge of destruction, you know, really until we sold the company. You know, our games weren't very successful. Even games that people love, System Shock 2, I think we sold like 130,000 copies of it. It's a very, very, very small number, and it's not enough to put bread on people's tables. I always had to wear that entrepreneurial hat, as well as my job making the games. I was the business guy in the company. As the games get bigger, that becomes a larger concern too, to some degree, because you're spending so much more on the game, and there's so many people who get involved in making it, and you have all these competing interests, and you want to honor, you know, the fans who've been with you for a very long time and make sure that you're making stuff that they view as an Irrational game, so you don't end up like Phil Collins post-Invisible Touch. You're still playing Supper's Ready in the concerts, to do a bad Genesis metaphor. You're still making games that honor those people and people who bought into what Irrational was at the very beginning. But as times change and your company gets larger, you also have to make sure that you're expanding your fan base and you're speaking to a modern audience and you're speaking to an audience of potentially millions. Making a game for potentially millions is a very challenging thing. How do you please 5 million people? It's a lot harder to please 5 million people than to please 100,000 people. Sometimes I think it gets very attractive, the thought of going and making some small independent game where you have two or three people working in your living room. I would love to make a Master of Magic style game. I would love to be able to make that game because that's the kind of game I love to play. It's just not really a practical consideration for a company like Irrational at this point. So how do you make those games that both honor that core mission that you have of the kind of games that you've always made but also could be appealing to 5 million people potentially? That's a super big challenge.
You guys are both now working on things that the stakes are higher, the expectations are higher. Ken, you said you'd love to work on some Master of Magic style thing. To rephrase an earlier question, is what Irrational is now, was that what you saw it being? And Karen, did you see yourself working on Thor, or is this just where you found yourselves and now you're just throwing your whole heart into it?
I always say I've got all the career instincts of a kamikaze pilot. Yeah. I'm not particularly good about thinking about the future. I generally obsess over the present to a stupid degree. I'm very, very hard to live with in that I don't turn off. And that kind of works in lieu of having any form of looking forward. The fact that my work appears to be acceptable at any one moment generally leads to more interesting things, especially because I don't put myself in a position where I'm responsible for enormous numbers of people. People often ask me, have you ever been tempted to go into development? I kind of realise it's not really where I'm wired in terms of working on one project for 1, 2, 3, 4 years. I'm not sure I could do that. There's one reason why journalism suits me, another reason why comics suits me. I can write a comic in a week, and then in like a couple of months' time, you'll be out.
I imagine going from doing game journalism to writing a comic where there's an artist waiting for you, there's a colorist waiting for you, there's an editor waiting for you. There's a boat that's moving, this boat of this franchise that's moving down the river and that you're now the captain of. That's very different than being one guy posting articles on a blog.
Yeah, totally. I think this was Alan Moore saying, the only fundamental sin is to leave your artist waiting for pages. Because the idea, the artist can only earn money when drawing pages. So if they don't have pages to draw, you're just making them not earn money. And it does actually help coming from the games journalism background, the over-strict deadlines, the fact that you just don't slip, means I'm pretty good at making sure I get stuff in people's hands. It's a responsibility, but it's kind of the job, you know? I'm quite big into self-discipline in that way. When I was primarily a games journalist and I was only doing comics for no money at all, as in literally small press stuff, I was very disciplined, as in I will do 3 or 4 pages of comics a night or whatever. And I would set myself a deadline, I would get this script done by then. Just because I'm aware of how procrastination eats into everything. I'm very aware I'm going to die. And if I slack off at stuff I haven't done before I died, and the fact that I don't really believe in the concept of an afterlife, so I'm very aware this is all I've got, so I've got to do everything very, very quickly.
Brian Michael Bendis, we had him on the show, gave us almost exactly the same thought. I was talking to him about his productivity, which is legendary. And he said the same thing. He said that basically he knows he's got so much time and he would kick himself if he didn't use up all that time practically and get it all done, which is odd to me because I'm sort of a famous procrastinator. You know, like when I do have a deadline, that really, really pushes me. It's strange in the game space because the comic book development process is so clear and so particular now, I imagine. Unless I'm missing my bet, I imagine there's a very particular way comics get done. The script's due on this day, the art's due on this day, the inking's done on this day, and then we go to press on that day, right, I presume?
So it's publication, basically. So there are deadlines, which are deadlines. The line you cross over, you get turned dead if you do that.
And games, because the technology's changing all the time, sometimes it's even hard to figure out when exactly things need to be done on the game side. So, like, you were not working from such a firm place. I wonder if I would be less procrastinatory if it was clear what the path of production was, because we just have no idea often. You know, I write a bit for Elizabeth in our new game. We've never done a companion character before. How early does that bit need to be done? I don't know, because we don't know how long it's going to take to do the rest of the part.
Well, you've also got to think about, what are things going to look like in 2012?
Yeah, we're working 3 years ahead of time in a very, very rapidly changing space.
The sort of flip of that in comics is that one of the most interesting things about the comics as a discipline is that you're writing for somebody. It's an interpretive form. So if I'm writing for Jamie McKelvey, my artist for Phonogram, it's very different than if I would write for Doug Braithwaite, who one of the artists I work with for. This is what the guy can do. This is what their strengths are. This is stuff they excel at. This is what they like doing. I occasionally describe writing a comic script as writing a kind of love letter. You're basically trying to seduce an artist into doing something well which they don't really want to do. I think that's the equivalent of the moving target of what is acceptable in 2012.
It's like a seduction with an artist. What exactly is going to make them do the thing you want them to do and get the image on the page you want them to get?
This is my first memory of video games. There was an Australian game called The Hobbit. It was based around the Tolkien. It was a text adventure. I didn't have a computer. My parents were quite technophobic. My best friend basically told me about this game. And he, for several weeks as a trial, he told me about, oh, yeah, I've got past the trolls now, and, you know, they turned to stone. And, yeah, and the elves are proving tricky. I'm trying to get them to put me in a barrel, and this is all. And I'm listening to this. And, oh, my God, this is like the best thing in the entire fucking world ever. In a couple of weeks' time, I go to his house, and he sits me down, he loads it up on the Spectrum, I'm suddenly going, oh my God, you never ever told me it was just text. You know, and that's video. And that, for me, that's video games. It's what it could be and what it actually is. Awkward disappointment and excitement all wrapped together.
To me, a substantial part of the fun is anticipating video games at this point. Like, there will be a game that I'll be looking forward to intensely for months, and then I'll actually get the package and it will sit unopened on my desk for a few days, or maybe even months, or maybe even never sometimes, because there's like a thing that I've been playing in my head for a while. But I think that's half the fun of it. I mean, if you're really a fan, anticipation is half the joy.
Games are always kind of more exciting when you don't know how the AI works. It's that point when it actually becomes, what could they do? I mean, we've talked about Boiling Point before. Boiling Point, you know, this incredibly, excitingly shoddy Ukrainian game.
But incredibly ambitious.
Incredibly ambitious and awesome and like heartwarming, but also basically with flying Jaguars. That's the... If you Google up flying Jaguars, you'll find amazing things.
You wrote two reviews, right?
I wrote three reviews. I handed them in together and it's basically, you know, this review is also completely positive. One was like 9 out of 10, the other one was like 2 out of 10. And the third one was, you must understand, both of these reviews are true. It's always questions, how much does bugs actually bother you? Some people do have different tolerance for bugs. I think the more PC gamer you are, I think the more you'll put up with complete nonsense to play the game.
I mean, a game is a system you interact with, and there's often a tendency to try to boil games down to an objective judgment. It's always entirely dependent on the experience one has with another.
Once you realize it's a bunch of systems, I remember when I was a screenwriter, when I learned about the three-act structure. Like, I knew that at page 30, you get to a point of tension, and that changes the action that goes into the second act for the next 60 pages. And you have act 2 at the end of page 90, and that leads to the conclusion at the end. And once I realized that all movies were structured that way, it really hurt my ability to enjoy movies because it wasn't magic anymore. Everything we see that seems like magic, there's actually a way to make it, and that's how people can make them so consistently. So I think there's a double-edged sword with video games where the more you know about it, the more you read Gama Sutra, the more you watch interviews with people, the less your ability to enjoy it on a magic level. But maybe you're increasing your ability to enjoy it on a meta level. Kieran was saying about Boiling Point. Even though he saw the bugs, he could still appreciate the intent and what they were trying to do. Where if somebody else saw the floating Jaguar, they would just turn off because, like, oh, that's stupid. That doesn't make any sense.
Where do you fall along that spectrum as a game maker? Because you mentioned films, but, I mean, what about games?
I have to do a lot of forcing myself not to know what's going on and not to appreciate it professionally. It's much harder now to appreciate things. I kind of ruin games for myself. TV, episodic TV, I think I enjoy more now because I haven't really dug into it to figure out how it works.
I've ruined my ability to read comics for at least 5-6 years. I used to drive an old girlfriend mad by sitting there and counting panels. Okay, this number of panels per page is for this aesthetic effect. How many panels in the comic? Questions of hardcore mathematics of story versus time versus space. It's like learning a musical instrument. I always remember learning bass guitar. Every time I went to a club, all I ever listened to was the bass guitar. I like to think after about 5, 6, 7 years, when you've metabolized it a bit, you can kind of turn it on and off a little bit more. As in, I can read comics more for enjoyment now, again. There always is going to be the part of you which is the craftsperson guy. You're not just there for the story, you're kind of working in the field.
If I had a switch in my body that could turn off my knowledge about movies and games, I really wish I could flip that switch, because there's just a way that people can enjoy stuff who've never worked on it or never thought about it, had to think about it in that kind of critical way. There's a kind of joy there that becomes much more difficult to tap into.
Now, I mean, you've got to put yourself in the position of thinking, okay, what about all the people who are going to play this who don't have that lens they see? I mean, what can you do that will surprise them, even if, as the creator, it doesn't have that same effect on you?
We tend to spend a lot of time thinking about the more savvy audience. For instance, exploits, right? Most people wouldn't even know what an exploit was. You know, most gamers who buy games, there are the hardcore who understand an exploit and they'll beat on an exploit and that will ruin the game for them. But we've had experiences all the time where people think that things actually have an effect on the game and are actually having a substantial effect on the game, but actually have no effect on the game in the simulation whatsoever.
That's great if you can create an environment where people get into the sort of brain space where they're willing to read into things. That seems like that in itself is a success, even though you didn't build it in explicitly.
Yeah, but there's going to be a substantial part of your audience that is going to be much more educated. And so you can't overly rely upon that for best.
The trick is stopping and discovering it. Games are basically a magic trick, aren't they? As in that when people see the magic trick being done, it's got, oh, I get it. It's like a lot of people, Heavy Rain, talk about the idea, oh, now I get how they did it.
Kieran, we're both friends with Andrew Mayer.
Yes.
An old friend of mine. People would debate about the end of Inception. What's the meaning of the spinning top at the end? is it mean that it was a dream or was it not a dream? And what Drew said to me, well, it was really interesting, it's not a dream and it's not a dream, it's a movie. Mm-hmm. It's all a fake, right? And it's all a facade and it's all a mystery, but it's still a meaningful debate. People still want to have that debate, even though it's a completely meaningless debate. It's irrelevant what it was. You're just going up or down a layer in the dream, and if you want to get into an existential argument about that, you can. I just love that point that he made. I thought it was great.
That sounds like a good place to wrap it up.
Kieran, listen, thank you for this. We really appreciate your taking the time.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to talk about you guys.
This podcast was produced by Jim Bonney and Chris Remo. Music by The Happy Hollows.